Dr. Shani graduated from Memorial High School in Spring Branch ISD and is now back with us in the Houston area here. He is one of our physicians at our Greater Heights Hospital, which is at 610 and Ella, and is the team doctor for St. Pius and Lutheran South, and also works Lutheran North, and also works some with Waltrip High School.
Thank you for having me today. More than happy to talk about some common foot and ankle sports injuries. This topic is enormous, and we're just going to touch on some main injuries. Rather than go through every anatomic foot and ankle part, we're just going to go through some major injuries that I think will be useful to you in your practice. I have no disclosures. Here's the general outline of topics I'm going to talk about, but if you have any questions about each of the topics or have any of the topics you want to discuss, more than happy to talk now. This is going to be a two-part talk. The second part is going to continue in our breakout session. We talk more about the physical exam and some clinical pearls and some sideline tips and techniques that can help you. So we'll be talking about less about ankle fractures, more about ankle sprains, and I've divided the topic into injuries that occur acutely and versus more kind of chronic ailments to the athletes that more occur on a daily basis, right, without any trauma. So we'll talk about first about ankle sprains, divided up to low and high ankle sprains. Low ankle sprains are much more common than high ankle sprains. They generally involve the lateral aspect of the ankle joint. It occurs in about 90% of our low ankle sprains, and low ankle sprains actually account for the most amount of missed games of any other injury within sports. So this is very common and can lead to problems with getting your athletes back into play. And the main thing you want to know about ankle sprains are very common, but you want to know when an ankle sprain is just not an ankle sprain. And we'll go into what other things they could be in the rest of the talk. But first, let's understand what a low ankle sprain is. In order to understand it, you have to understand the anatomy of the ankle. We start with breaking it down into three main ligaments: the anterior talofibular ligament, the calcaneal fibular ligament, and the posterior talofibular ligament. Each part of these ankle ligaments control a different part of the stability within the ankle. The ATFL is the most common one that's injured, and it's injured in plantar flexion and inversion, whereas the CFL, located connecting the calcaneus and the fibula, is more in dorsiflexion and inversion. And this is important when you're testing the ankle joint to see which one has been involved in understanding where these ligaments are. Most common is the ATFL that's injured, and that's more of a lower energy mechanism. And then when more of these ligaments are injured, it becomes more of a higher energy mechanism. So when we look at low ankle sprains, it clinically presents with pain with weight bearing, swelling in the localized area, and catching and popping sensation. In your physical exam, you'll see focal tenderness around the ankle joint that's involved. And you should be well-versed in knowing how to do an anterior drawer exam. So when you see the laxity in anterior drawer with the foot in plantar flexion, it's more the ATFL. When it's more in dorsiflexion, it's more the CFL. Classifications are like any other orthopedic classifications you've seen. They go from mild to moderate to more severe. Grade 1 being more of a stretch, and grade 3 being a rupture of the ligaments, and grade 2 being somewhere in between. There are more clinical definitions of it, looking at the ATFL and the CFL, but basically you want to kind of partition about that when you're kind of explaining this to your students and your students' parents, that it ranges from grade 1 to grade 3, with grade 3 being more severe and more ligaments being involved. So the main question is, when do you need to say, okay, this is more than an ankle sprain, and we need to get an x-ray to evaluate this? And this is defined and characterized by the Ottawa rules, which I'm sure you've had some experience with it. You see the inability to bear weight, focal tenderness over the medial and lateral malleolus, fifth metatarsal tenderness. This is the kind of one that's often missed. When there is an ankle sprain, they're doing okay, but they have that focal tenderness over the fifth metatarsal, and that could indicate a fracture or any other injury around that fifth metatarsal complex. So you want to make sure you palpate the fifth metatarsal and also the navicular bone to make sure they don't have a hairline fracture of the navicular bone. And this is an x-ray showing stress views, and this is why it's sometimes important also when you don't feel crepitus, you don't feel it's a fracture, you think it's an ankle sprain, you want to make sure that if you do send them in, that we get stress views to see and test the actual instability, because what may be minor may actually be more severe, as you can see in this x-ray where there's complete instability of the ankle joint. So the treatment, we all know, the RICE. The question is, do we quickly get them mobilized? Do we quickly get them, put them weight on it? How do we control their pain and getting their pain down, inflammation down, so that we can start rehab quicker? And what kind of brace? Is it something where we tape up? Is it something we use an air cast for? Or is it something we use a lace-up brace? We don't know the answer to this. They all work, and it's more what can be comfortable to your athlete and getting them back. For a lot of athletes, they prefer the taping because it's a little bit more stable. They can feel like they can participate. They can practice with it when their pain is going. And there may be a role to transition between the two versus not. But the main thing that therapy should focus on is proprioception and early perineal and muscle strengthening around the ankle joint to get them back and moving. I think if we look at the studies now, we're moving towards getting them, putting them weight on it, getting them early therapy, getting them back quicker. But it has to be modified by their pain, and you need to be looking at the other aspects of what could be injured, and as we'll discuss later, within an ankle sprain. So complications after an ankle sprain. When I looked up the stat, it was surprising. About the 50% of patients who have, 50% of athletes who have ankle sprains complain of still pain after 3 to 4 weeks of rest and rehabilitation. That's a significant amount. And the reason why is that there are a significant amount of missed injuries that can occur with an ankle, just what's considered a low ankle sprain. So what else can go wrong? An anterior process of fracture of the calcaneus, pain over the lateral aspect of the talus, fifth metatarsal and osteochondral lesions and injuries to the peroneal tendons. We're going to delve into this more in the breakout session, but these are things that I want you to keep in mind when you're thinking, okay, I got a low ankle sprain. I need to look at this in my athlete. Do they have something else that could be indicative of something else going on? This is in contrast to a high ankle sprain. Less common, but also very, very important to understand and can lead to more time being away from sports. So when we understand, when we look at the anatomy here, this pictorial diagram is more helpful than the actual anatomical one. Here you can see the three ligaments of the ankle. Contrast that to the syndesmotic ligaments here, which is the anterior tibiofibular ligament, which is now instead of looking at ligaments that stabilize the outside of the ankle joint based on the fibula, we're looking between the tibia and the fibula, those ligaments. They consist of the four ligaments around that connect the tibia and the fibula, the anterior inferior talofibular ligament, the posterior inferior talofibular ligament, the interosseous ligament, and the interosseous membrane. This goes back to what Dr. Meeks was talking about, how this interosseous membrane can go all the way up to the proximal tibia, can lead to proximal tibiofibular instability. So you can see how these ligaments can be intertwined with knee pain all the way down to ankle pain, and you need to understand that this is also pathology. So when we look at high ankle sprains physical examination, again, we're going to delve more into it in the breakout session, but you have tennis palpation over the AITFL touching right over this area, right over here. Difficulty with weight bearing. More often, you see difficulty with weight bearing with high ankle sprains and low ankle sprains. Syndesmotic tenderness, that's when you have the best return to predictor to play. So as we're following your athletes as they're returning from sport, you'll notice that when they're getting right to back to play, that syndesmotic tenderness and that is getting less and less, and that's a great indicator to say, okay, you're getting better, you're making progress, or we're able to get you back to participate. The squeeze test is also very important, the external rotation test, as you can see right here. The examiner is doing external rotation tests, and this is the x-ray correlation. You can see that there's widening of this joint, which has caused widening of the medial clear space, and this is a very unstable ankle. They should not be allowed to play until they had their ankle stabilized, because they can lead to greater injuries to the cartilage and osteochondral lesions. So that's why we recommend getting x-rays for this, doing stress views to see if there's any particular damage in the area. So high ankle sprains, how do you get these? You can see right here, pretty high energy energy, and about 13% are associated with fractures, 15% associated with OCD lesions, and 25%. One in every four high ankle sprains is associated with a peroneal injury. So that's why it's very important to do a complete examination when you identify these types of injuries. And the biomechanics, once again, stabilizes the tibia fibula. It widens about 1 millimeter to gait and it maintains that medial mortise, which you saw in the last x-ray. So non-operative, when do you treat these operatively and when do these can be treated with non-operative measures? It's all based on stability. And that's the topic that I want you to remember when we talk about other injuries. It's all based on what the clinical stability is of that ankle. If it's a stable ankle, you can treat it non-operatively. If it's not stable, you've got to treat it operatively. So the indications, when we treat it non-operatively, it's based on with the Cam Walker boot for 2-3 weeks to delay weight bearing until the patient is completely pain-free and doesn't display any signs of instability. You can treat it with an external rotation brace if you think the patient needs it. Operative, what do we do operatively? Well, we stabilize the syndesmotic joint. We can do that. This is actually very controversial how we stabilize it. It can be done with screws, it can be done with rope, it can be with one screw, two screws, and the main need we need to rehabilitate it. I think in athletes these days, we're leaning towards more of the suture fixation because possible early return to play, avoid the second surgery, but still the gold standard is putting the one or two screws in and then removing the screws so they can get back to play. So what we do with those screws is we would reduce this ankle joint over here and then put a screw right across it, a screw or a button fixation to reduce this and bring this tibia and fibula back together to decrease the overlap, to increase the overlap between those two joints. So return to play. more and more we're going towards a more functional return to play rather than any time. But you're going to get your students' parents or your students asking, how long am I going to be out? So just as a rule of thumb, we say grade 1, 1 to 2, grade 2, 2, 1 to 2, this is what I do. And grade 3, few weeks in high ankle, depending on 7 weeks. But I caution you to avoid that. I caution you to go more with functional stability, functional testing, when their gait's normal, when they're able to do stability in single leg stance, where they can perform these other sport-specific items and then get them back based off of that and telling your athletes and your athletes' parents that we're going to see how he does. But invariably, they're always going to ask some sort of timeline. So you can give them a rule of thumb, but if they can fulfill these criteria, that's more important. So moving away from sprains, let's talk about talar osteochondral lesions. Very common with high energy ankle sprains and high energy ankle fractures. This is something that's often missed by some orthopedic surgeons, and it needs to be, you need to keep an eye on it. And the main thing that you'll notice in osteochondral lesions more than low ankle sprains is you'll see anterior swelling of the ankle joint rather than lateral swelling. If they can persist with anterior swelling of the joint, you've got to be thinking, there's something else going on. Is there an osteochondral lesion of the talus that we're missing? The way you can identify it is x-rays. Here's an MRI picture of the osteochondral lesion. You see the normal cartilage here, and you see this cartilage bone bruise of the posterior aspect of the ankle joint. 90% of this are trauma, 10% come from repetitive injuries. They're divided into two types, medial and lateral, based on how superficial and how traumatic. The lateral is more superficial and more based on trauma, which we'll see, but the medial is the deeper and less traumatic ones. And that's based off where we see it in the coronal plane, lateral versus medial. So what do these osteochondral lesions look like? This is an arthroscopic image. This is an arthroscopic image of the talus. We're doing a scope here. You see the loose osteochondral fragment, and when it's removed, you have basically this divot. This divot can be treated with microfracture, debridement, oats, different types of technique based on your patient's age group and the chronicity of the fracture, of the chronicity of the lesion. But this is what we want to avoid, and we want to make initial diagnosis with the patient who may have a sprain that we're also looking for osteochondral lesions of the talus. Moving on, again, we're going to go through a lot of topics here. The next injury I want to talk about is Achilles tendon injuries. Now, we see those a lot more in our 30 to 40, but it is common in our football athletes as well. You'll commonly say that they hear a pop in the back of their ankle, or they've got kicked in the back of their ankle, that feeling. Clinical exam, you'll see a focal defect you'll palpate a focal defect in the back of the ankle, and they'll have a significant amount of swelling and pain. The rupture usually occurs about 4 to 6 centimeters from the insertion site. This is actually, on this picture, we actually see this is a distal avulsion, but usually it's about right over here in the mid-substance of the 4 to 6 centimeters from the ankle joint. And Thompson test, which we'll get into in our clinical breakout sessions, but place the patient prone, you squeeze the calf, and you see active plantar flexion. We usually perform surgery on this, and then return to play is 6 to 9 months based on their function. The Liz Frank injury. The story behind this is Dr. Liz Frank was back in the Napoleonic era, and a soldier came back from a horse ride and got his foot stuck in the stirrup, fell, developed gangrene, compartment syndrome in his foot, had to have an amputation through the transmetatarsal joint. And therefore, we have Liz Frank injuries based off that. So if you want an injury named after yourself, go do something like that. What is it? The Liz Frank joint, or the ligament, is connecting the medial cuneiform to the second metatarsal. It occurs through an axial load with hyperflexion of the tarsal metatarsal joint, leading to subluxation of the tarsal metatarsal joint. Presents with severe pain. You're not going to miss this. They're going to have severe pain. They're going to have inability to their weight. Clinically, you'll see a bruising over the plantar aspect of the foot. They'll have midfoot swelling. And so with the clinical vignette you want to see here is an athlete who comes with a midfoot sprain versus an injury. Obviously, the main ligament injuries, if they have big fracture dislocation, you're going to notice it. But when you have those midfoot sprains and they're continuing to have sprain, how do you know? Is it a Liz Frank injury, or is it just something that we're going to treat non-operatively, just a stretch of that ligament? So the main thing you want to know about that is the less the swelling and instability testing. Again, it comes back to the syndesmosis. You're going to see this kind of repetitive topic. You want to test the stability. How do you test the stability of a Liz Frank joint? Well, there's clinical exam. You grab the foot and you do a shuck test. Also, the next test is to get an x-ray, a weight-bearing x-ray, and seeing if there's any diastasis of that Liz Frank joint. And so you want to kind of, you want to look at the clinical vignette and you want to see how much pain they're having and if there's any instability, and then you can make the referral for an x-ray. If they get the x-ray, they can see what needs to be done, if it needs to be stabilized or if it doesn't need to, can be treated non-operatively. So again, non-operative management for stable Lisfranc injuries or people who are unfit for surgery, and stabilization can be confirmed with screws, which screws can be removed later, or as we did with the syndesmotic injuries, rope fixation, or sensory fixation. This is a significant injury. If they do have surgery, they're out for 9 to 12 months, and in many instances, if it's a high enough injury, they can develop arthritis, and which may need to a fusion of their ankle joint. Moving on to fifth metatarsal injuries, I like to think of it as breaking it up to, you know, not so bad, bad, and not so bad again. So when we base it off of that, we can see that they're based off of three types of fifth metatarsal fractures. The one you see in the blue is usually an avulsion. We call this a zone one injury. Usually it's an avulsion from the long plantar muscle or the peroneal brevis muscle that's attached to the proximal fifth metatarsal. Usually, this can be treated non-operatively with a walker boot or a hard sole shoe. They get better in a couple weeks, and they can be treated symptomatically and return to play when the symptoms resolve. Now, the Jones fracture. The reason why this is called the Jones fracture was a defining characteristic. It's a fracture that is more distal to the avulsion fracture, but extends into the fourth and fifth metatarsal joint. Now, that's the reason why that's important is that the blood supply is decreased, because the blood supply comes from the proximal metatarsal and goes over here. So because of its decreased blood supply, it's harder for it to heal. And there's a move in higher level athletes to go ahead and just fix it rather than waiting. Traditionally, this has been treated in a cast, but in a higher level elite athletes, we're moving towards fixing this with a screw to stabilize it to get them back to return to play rather than waiting for it to heal, because it can take a while for it to heal just because the blood supply is poor. The third fracture, as you see in the red, is more of a stress fracture, more of a chronic runner, more of a chronic injury. And this, you'll see more of subtle pain that they've been having for quite a period of time. Once again, we treat this in non-weight bringing a cast and our high-level athletes. If they continue to have pain after a certain period of time, then you would go and fix it. Rather than a Jones fracture, you could treat that acutely. Next topic we're going to talk about is turf toe. So we're kind of moving away from a little bit of the injuries more to more chronic pathologies. So turf toe is something that usually occurs chronically. You kind of notice it chronically. They say they had their pain, they may have injury, but it didn't bother them initially, but now it's bothering when they play. You'll notice it's an inability to push off. They say, I can't push off. It's just something is bothering me there. They'll have pain on the plantar aspect or ball of their toes, and it's due to a hyperextension injury. You can see the plantar plate connecting the first metatarsal to the first proximal phalanx. This plantar plate is ruptured or stretched, and it may involve sesamoid and hyperextend like that. Again, it's same type of classification, partial versus tear versus complete tear, graded from 1 to 2 to 3. Here's an MRI image, you're seeing the rupture of the plantar plate. You may also see on an x-ray a sesamoid retraction, and you typically can treat this with rest, NSAIDs, taping, a stiff sole shoe. So when do you need to operate on this? It's, once again, based on the stability. So you'll test it through a vertical Lachman examination. If you see gross instability and pain, and the MRI shows a complete rupture, it may need to be repaired in a higher level athletes. Lower level athletes, you maybe get away with doing that, but it's got to be based on the symptoms and their episodes of instability. So this is why the clinical exam, I think, is very important in foot and ankle diagnosis. Next thing we're going to talk about is posterior impingement. The clinical vignette you'll see in this is a ballet dancer or any athlete that has to hyperextend their foot. In this x-ray, you see an os trigonum. You can imagine if the foot is plantar flexed, this os trigonum can impinge on the posterior tibia and cause pain. Versus contrast that with anterior ankle impingement, you see the anterior osteophyte, you see this little divot here in the anterior talus. This occurs more of our athletes who play on grass, who have hyperflexion injuries, who are wearing their cleats, and hyperdorsiflexion injuries. So posterior impingement versus anterior impingement, similarly way you want to treat this, initially NSAIDs, therapy to focus in on decreasing swelling in the area. If that doesn't seem to improve, we perform arthroscopic incisions where we scope the area, clean up the osteophytes here, or possibly remove the os trigonum. The os trigonum you can appreciate here in this arrow right here. And the os trigonum is basically a bony outlay from the posterior aspect of the talus. The next thing I want to talk about is extensor compartment syndrome. And we're almost finishing up here. This is actually something I just saw in my clinic a couple weeks ago, and here you'll see the athlete who complains of shin pain. and you want to distinguish this from shin splints. And you'll see that they'll say, after I ran for 15 to 20 minutes, my calf started to hurt. I started to feel numbness in the dorsum of my foot, the top of the foot, and possibly a cool sensation in the foot. If you think about that, if you hear someone says, I feel these paresthesias, then you should sing, ding, ding, ding. I think I have an external compartment syndrome. What's the next step? How do I evaluate that? And the way we evaluate that is through compartment testing. And you have the athlete go out, run. You first test them before they run. You test the pressure. And then you have them go out and run. Then you stick a pressure gauge in these four compartments. The four compartments of the calf are the anterior, lateral, deep posterior, and the superficial posterior. More often than 90% of the time is involving the anterior and the lateral compartments. The diagnosis is when the compartment's pressure, resting pressure is greater than 15, after 1 minute stays above 30, and after 15 minutes it stays above 15 millimeters of mercury. So if you have this athlete who comes in with these paresthesias and they say, I run, I get them, and then I have to wait half an hour before my symptoms go away, it should be triggering you a warning sign. How do we treat these? A lot of these can be treated with just better running mechanics, changing their, maybe getting them orthotic, looking at their hip range of motion and strengthening of their hip and their quad strengthening. So we can treat these, a majority of these, non-operatively. But if they don't, then you have to do a fasciotomy. And a fasciotomy is a pretty significant procedure where you have to release. You mind starting it again? I'll go back down to where I was. You have to release the fascia around here to open up the space. And so what's going on here is the reason why they're developing compartment syndrome is that they're developing swelling within the calf that leads to decreased blood flow to the calf just due to the pressure that's in the calf. And that can lead to irreversible ischemia to the nerves. And that's why they get these paresthesias. So that's why you have to open up the space so the compartments can swell enough so they don't compress the blood flow to the area. And so that's what we would do, a fasciotomy, and release it. You can do it through one incision, a single incision technique, and we could talk about that more if you have questions on the technical aspects of how you do a fasciotomy. Finally, I wanted to contrast that with a stress fracture. So this is another athlete who's complaining of tibial pain, but it's not necessarily the paresthesias you see. It's more of as soon as I start to run, or even after I run a little bit, I have pain, but I don't have these paresthesias, and the compartments are soft. And this is more of our chronic runners, our military athletes. And you can see right here, you can see what we call the dreaded black line. And you can see the stress fracture that extends to the anterior cortex. Now, you won't always see that. Sometimes you'll just have to get a negative X-ray, and MRI is what's needed to see the stress fracture. And what it is the microfractures of the trabecula in the bone over here that's causing the stress fracture. It can be very painful, and you'll see focal tenders. Another clinical difference is you'll see focal tenders over the mid-aspect of the tibia that will kind of give you a hint that this may be a stress fracture. We'll get an X-ray, possibly an MRI. Now, if they have this dreaded black line, then you really have to consider stabilizing this because this could propagate and become a full fracture, as we saw in the athlete from Louisville. And we stabilize that with intramedullary rotting. So these were just a few topics that I thought were important to discuss. If you have any questions or want to discuss any more topics, we can talk more about the breakout session, but I wanted to pick a few clinical topics and go from there. Thank you for your time.
What is your thoughts on the stress fractures for the tibia with bone stimulators and whatnot?
I think they have a role in athletes that don't have the dreaded black line. I think if you have the dreaded black line, you have to really cautious, especially in a high-level athlete. If the athlete's willing to wait and see with the bone stimulator and feels like they have time before they want to get back to sport, then it's worth an option.